Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Brown University pre-college programs, where high school students can prepare for college success, experience college life, and make new friends from around the world. More than 300 courses are available. Precollege.brown.edu.
Online at WGBHnews.org. Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Braddock. If we thought closing schools down was complicated, opening them is proving to be harder, and one fun-loving family in Sudbury is not helping. Join us online to talk about all the ways the coronavirus is affecting education from high school to higher ed is Paul Revel. Paul's a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book is co-authored with Lane Weiss and is called Broader, Bolder, Better, How Schools and Communities Help Students Overcome the Disadvantages of Poverty. Hello to you, Paul Revel.
Hello, Jim and Marjorie. I missed seeing you too, but good to be back with you.
Thank
good
you very
you,
much,
Paul.
Paul Revel. So Governor Baker is putting pressure on 16 communities, particularly that have low numbers of coronavirus, to get some timelines on when they're going to get back to school. The education commissioner is pushing the same thing, Jeff Riley. So are they right to do this? Do they need to get these kids back sooner?
Well, I mean, I think it's a reasonable position they're taking. They're looking at 16 districts who have been on the green list in terms of the positivity rates in their communities being low for about 7 weeks, as I understand it. And they're saying they don't think there's justification for being entirely remote there, that they should be doing at least some in-person in a hybrid model. And they're pushing that and putting a little pressure on it by a kind of veiled threat to audit these communities if they don't conform. Now, you're right, in this area, the Department of Education, the state, can't technically order local districts when to be in session and when not to be in session or how to be in session. And so there's a question of authority here. So there's a little nudging and influencing going on, and we'll see where it all comes out.
But, you know, there was a piece, I have a couple of things out of it, what you said, Paul. There was a piece I'm sure you saw in the Boston Globe the other day, suggesting that there are two different kinds of approaches in Rhode Island and here, where I think they referred, the writers of the piece said that Gina Raimondo, who will be with us Tuesday, by the way, on the radio here, was more like an education czar running a political campaign through the summer, even though I don't think she has any more statutory power to dictate openings than does Charlie Baker, correct me if I'm wrong. And she's been more successful. It seems to me that he's trying to get tougher. And you mentioned a minute ago, and so I'm curious to know what you think of that comparison. But secondly, you said Riley was asked a question at the governor's press conference today. If they don't agree to bring students back in those 16 districts, what happens? He said what you said could lead to everything up to and including an audit. What is an audit?
Well, I think in this case, they're sort of narrowly specifying an audit that might apply to examining how online instruction is going in their communities. I think the typical superintendent these days would be reluctant to have such an audit because school districts, despite their best efforts, but particularly after a long lag in the summer, are not up to state-of-the-art performance. There's a lot of dissatisfaction among parents about the quality of online education. I heard from a parent this morning complaining, she thought hybrid was going to be terrific until her children actually started doing it. And the difficulty the teachers were having going back and forth between working with students who were in person and working with students who were online was really complicating and difficult, and she wasn't at all happy with it. So I think the typical district does not want their online education to be audited because that would put in the spotlight in the local community, the levels of dissatisfaction that exist. So as to your earlier question, I think this is a situation where governors have to kind of indicate where it is on their scale of priorities. I think Governor Raimondo put it higher on her list of priorities, the focus on education, than we did here in this state. And that doesn't necessarily mean the outcome is better. I'm not clear by what scale we can say Rhode Island is doing better. They may have more of, you know, it's just I don't know what the indicators are to suggest that. But I think the our state, Governor Baker and Jeff Riley have been concerned all along. They've been cautious. They've watched the changing numbers. They've been criticized for not coming out with clear guidance early enough in the summer. So I think they're, you know, I think they're now sort of getting ahead of things and saying, really, we have a metric system, a way of measuring the level of risk in local communities, and we have convictions. If there's, you know, very low risk in your community, we expect you to be going in person, because by all, you know, really by all standards, going in person is more effective than going online.
Well, two things about this. I mean, many of the teachers in these towns may not want to go back, and I'm not sure what you do about that if they don't want to go back. And the other thing is, since the numbers are so low, and they're probably not going to be zero for quite some, at least another year or so before we get this, or maybe sooner if we're lucky, this vaccine up and running, it's kind of like they're never going to go back, I guess.
I don't know, Marjorie, if zero is a realistic standard. I mean, none of us have zero risk in our lives. And I don't think we can guarantee teachers or school employees zero risk factors coming back. But I think they've arrived at what, you know, what they think is a reasonable standard. And I suppose reasonable people could disagree about whether where they're setting the bar is right. And they're not talking about everybody going back full time. But they are talking about, for example, remedying the real equity issue of certain categories of students who are not being well served online because they don't have the devices, they don't have the support at home, they don't have the space, they don't have the family stability. I mean, there's certain groups of students, special needs students, who, for example, can't be often well served by online education, and you want to do them in person. So hybrid takes in a variety of different kinds of approaches. So I think it's quite possible for districts to begin moving in the direction of providing some services to some children, particularly those most at risk of greater gaps developing in this crisis, and then move over time and see how the numbers go. I mean, many people, after all, are predicting we're going to have a resurgence of this virus. And it's going to push everybody back to being exclusively online in due course. We'll see. I hope not, but we're dealing with moving conditions here.
Paul Revel, you said a second ago that one of the reasons a threatened audit might be an effective stick, for lack of a better expression, is because communities, superintendents know that this remote learning thing is not going quite as well as they'd like, and they don't want it spelled out in great detail to the parents in their community. Is that a general statement? Meaning, I know it's early in the school year, but are the reports you're getting that remote learning, and we know that the spring was the first instance and there was no notice, and I think failures, at least if there were good intentions, were excusable. Is the beginning of the fall semester been a disappointment? In Massachusetts?
No, I wouldn't make that general statement, Jim, because I don't have any factual basis for making such a claim. But I will say my informal contact with parents and teachers has been, we're still on a kind of rising learning curve in terms of doing this. It isn't that it's necessarily terrible, although in some cases, some kids are off the map altogether and in relatively high numbers, not even connected into the new system. So, I mean, in some places, there are very high levels of dissatisfaction that are ongoing. In other places, it's just, they're learning. And so people are probably less satisfied, less comfortable than they were in the old order. And if you do a close audit, you're going to generate a lot of expression of those feelings that then becomes public information. And I'm not sure most districts want that. I mean, nobody particularly loves an audit coming into their community. This is not surprising. But, I think we've got a long way to go to getting online education up to state of the art. And, frankly, one of my concerns is that a lot of the summertime was not utilized for perfecting our practice.
But, Paul Revel, it just seems common sense tells you that in many, if not most, households, this is an impossible task. Mothers and fathers have jobs, and to be the at-home teacher for 6 and 7 and 8 year olds while you're trying to do your job is crazy. And I just, it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean,
and so I don't just, even know why anybody expects this to work, unless you're older kids.
It's a wild juggling act. And, it, you know, in certain circumstances, under very tight conditions, where you can count on a lot of support and space and equipment and so forth at home, you know, you can guarantee sort of high levels of quality. But, you know, for most public schools that are dealing with diverse populations who have very different family circumstances at home, the pulls on children away from sitting watching a screen, particularly when the teacher is struggling with how to do online education, they don't have teaching assistants, they may be simultaneously trying to teach to a class of students in front of them while also teaching to a group of kids who are online, it's an overwhelming task. It's not impossible, and there are pockets and ways it works out. I'm teaching online at Harvard right now, and the conditions have been set up to maximize success. So it's a reasonably successful experience, I think, for me and for the students. But I've got tons of support, and I've had lots of training in order to do it. And I'm just afraid that many of our school systems and our teachers and our families have not had the training and support that they need to make this work. So we've got a long way to go. And
when you say a long way to go, the implication is we'll get there. But is it possible that the long-term implications of this spring break in the action and then the fall break in the action, at least traditional education action, is going to have a permanent impact, or at least a really long-term impact? We read the stories about wealthier parents fleeing schools, parents that weren't so crazy about the public school system. Now was the impetus to say, let me get out of here. The thousands of kids that don't have mostly lower income kids that don't have the Chromebook yet, or don't have a decent right. computer, or don't have decent internet connection, or, you know, just aren't on, are lost for the moment. It seems to me that some of those things don't, we all look to the vaccine as the cure-all, literally and figuratively. Some of these things are going to be with us for a long, long time. Are they not? Some of the effects?
Yeah, there's no question. And I think we're going to see some residuals. In other words, some things that we've done to cope with the emergency are going to have sort of permanent implications and be with us indefinitely, even if we return to something like normalcy, and some won't. And some of the challenges will go away as we get better, and others won't. I mean, the kind of challenges Marjorie was just mentioning in terms of family circumstances and parents right. with two jobs, things of that nature, that's not going to change, that kind of pressure. On the other hand, we can do a better job of getting equipment and internet connection to students. We can do a better job of instruction. A lot of teachers are, you know, by default, just simply relying on what they used to be doing. I've heard countless stories, particularly at the college level, of professors just getting on and delivering the old lectures just to a video camera very passively, and students not interacting with them because you can't really speak at students for 45 minutes, an hour straight, without interactions in this kind of Zoom environment. It's just not working very effectively. So they have to change their practice to make it more interactive, to make it more engaging. Same is true for K-12 teachers. I mean, teachers learning how to engage, you know, 6, 7, 8 year olds and to hold their attention without a parent standing by. I mean, I have a grandchild in this age group. He can't really focus on the screen for more than 10 minutes without a parent there pushing him to do that, and he doesn't like being pushed. And so it's a lose-lose kind of situation. He's just not effectively connected despite the best intentions of his parents. So, you know, if those challenges are going to persist, and, you know, overall, I think the verdict is going to be most people are going to want to return to school. Now, you've raised the other point, and there's a lot of evidence in this that the, you know, the interest in homeschooling, the interest in a kind of a la carte education, particularly among affluent parents who can purchase services, curriculum, Russian math, and things like that off the internet, or can join, pandemic pods where they're doing after school or weekend or enrichment activities, or even creating their own little micro schools. There was an article in the New York Times recently about the number of parents in New York who never would have dreamed of homeschooling their kids, but suddenly they felt they weren't getting quality from the school system. They felt their children were at risk. They decided they'd try it, and to their surprise, they wound up liking it and forming relationships with other groups of parents and doing things with their children that hadn't been possible, and seeing their children more enthusiastic than they have been. So I think we're going to see more homeschooling whenever this goes back. I think we're going to see, a number of parents who won't want to take the vaccine for their kids and who will therefore be outside of schools. I think we're going to see more people sort of thinking of education. And this is what worries me. This is the biggest issue. Seeing education as purely a private good. This is something that in a Darwinian sort of free market, I do for my kids and my family, and it doesn't matter if there's any public good in terms of educating citizens, creating a culture, creating a society, creating a sense of community and obligation to one another. That public purpose takes a back seat in this sort of market-based model of going after education. So, I think policymakers are going to have to find a way to balance it. On the one hand, you want parents to have choice, to be able to do things. On the other hand, if it's unrestrained, unrestricted choice in a free market way, the advantaged are going to get further advantaged, the disadvantaged are going to get further disadvantaged, achievement gaps are going to grow, and we're going to have large numbers of young people not ready to participate in our economy or democracy.
So, Paul Revel, we mentioned before kerfuffle, I guess we could call it up. Dust up.
Yeah.
In Sudbury.
A big one.
This story just shows how difficult it is to get teenagers and young college kids to behave themselves in the age of coronavirus. And now this Sudbury couple and their high school age kid are in trouble. Tell us what happened here.
Well, apparently, and I don't know who was responsible, we don't have enough details about it, and it's not, particularly, it's not strictly a corona problem. This is the kind of problem that would happen periodically all the time.
Absolutely. Drinking.
There were parties like this throughout my teenage years, and, parents had a hard time controlling it. Oftentimes, you'd have parties at a kid's home when the parents were away. The parents didn't even know about it, yet they were held accountable for it. So kids do this, and they continue to do it during COVID, but the implications and ramifications of doing it are enormous. And in this case, it caused the delay of school by, a week or two. They delayed school opening there at Lincoln Sudbury High School. And it also created a huge risk factor for those children and their families. The incentives and punishments associated with it caused a lot of the kids who were involved not to even report that they were there. So they're sort of flying under the radar and maybe transmitting the disease to other people. So, there are problems with the kind of punitive environment we've set up about identifying your involvement in something like this. And the same thing applies on our college campuses. We're seeing the same thing in the colleges. Providence College has been in the headlines a lot lately, and other places like Notre Dame. And,
those Catholic schools, Paul, they're out of line.
That's right. I know. The colleges have always had trouble controlling underage drinking, whether on campus
Absolutely.
Or on campus.
Absolutely.
And now they're being asked to control fraternization. And who can enforce this off campus? You can't send campus police into people's homes off campus, and the local police don't want to be enforcing it. And it's no easier to control now than it ever was. And they're at their limits. It's just that the implications are profound. And if you take the most cautious behavior, then you're just going to close it down and do everything online so as not to create that temptation. And after all, kids in their teen years and early 20s are the most likely to resist compliance with norms and regulations on their behavior.
Absolutely.
And they continue to do these things. And well, I'm likely to do so in the future.
Well, Paul, thank you very much. I think you're absolutely right. There, to keep those kids from fraternizing is a very difficult, task. Remember the great story about the guy that used to be the assistant DA in Suffolk County? Jim said this wasn't true, but it really was true. A friend of mine who shall not be named. He's upstairs, you know, with the wife. They're watching TV in the second floor. Meanwhile, down in the finished basement, they got like 35 kids having a, wild. They had no idea. Anyway,
so
Paul.
So they said.
I believe them.
That
could be me.
What's that? What's that?
One of my daughters said that to me the other day. No such thing as a socially distanced party.
That's right. She's right. Hey, Paul, thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul Revel.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Paul Revel joins us regularly. I think they didn't know it. I mean, parents fall asleep, you know, Jim. And who knows what's going on in those finished basements.
No, there are 50 kids in the basement. You're
know what
up
happens?
One floor. You'd never know.
You know what happens, Jim? You finish your basement, you're asking for trouble. That's all
exactly.
I can say. Anyway, Paul Revel is a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, co-authored with Elaine Weiss, is Broader, Bolder, Better, How Schools and Communities Help Students Overcome the Disadvantages of Poverty. Coming up, if you thought Gore versus Bush was rough, Trump is poised, as in President Trump, is poised to make that election seem like a day at the beach. We're opening our lines, asking you about the president's latest comments rejecting the notion of a peaceful transition of power in the United States of America. This is 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Take a moment and